The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Now, is Trump breaking up with Europe? A national strategy plan released by the Trump administration earlier this week, or over last weekend really, described Europe as weak and questioned whether the continent had a strong enough defence and economy to be an ally of the US. The document said Europe risks civilizational erasure because of immigration and progressive social policies in Europe. Now, between tariffs, lawsuits against American tech giants, and Trump's push to halt the war in Ukraine on Russia's terms, the rift between the EU and the US has been growing.
I know the good leaders, I know the bad leaders, I know the smart ones, I know the stupid ones. You got some real stupid ones too. But they're not doing a good job. Europe is not doing a good job in many ways. They're not doing a good job.
I want to ask you about
that. They talk too
much,
and they're not producing. We're talking about Ukraine. They talk, but they don't produce. And the war just keeps going on and on.
Well, European leaders have pushed back on the US president's assessment of Europe. Our own Taoiseach Micheál Martin has insisted that the EU is still strong.
I also would disagree with President Trump's description of Europe as weak. Obviously, it depends on how one defines strength. But Europe is one of the strongest continents in the world in terms of economic strength. Actually, that's manifested in the EU-US trade agreement. Inherently in that agreement is a recognition of the strength of Europe economically. If you look at how Europe performed during the pandemic, it was a strong performance.
Now, John O'Brien, Professor of European Integration at Maynooth University, joins me now. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, you saw this coming.
Absolutely. I think it should have been obvious to anybody who was paying attention that Trump 2.0 was a very different beast to the first Trump administration. From early in the year, I think it was obvious that the hostility to Europe was going to have real material effects. And what it means now, I think, Pat, is that we've reached this really pivotal moment. The alliance between the United States and Europe goes back at least to World War One and World War II, but formally to the foundation of NATO in 1949. What the Americans have signaled, I think, not just in the US national security strategy published last Friday, but in comment after comment from Trump and from Pete Hegseth, his Secretary of State for War, and others, is that the alliance is effectively over. I don't think there's anybody in Europe left who believes that the United States would come to the rescue of one of the Baltic states, for example, if they were to be attacked by Russia.
So you're talking about Article 5 of the NATO treaty, which insists that if you attack one, you attack all, and therefore all respond.
Exactly. And of course, the irony here is that the only time Article 5 has been triggered is by the United States at the request of the United States after the attacks on 9/11. But I think the more important thing here is the geopolitical change that is happening. The United States, unbelievably for some, has pivoted so much that it is now a firm ally of the authoritarian powers, Russia and China. Trump makes his admiration for Putin and Xi no secret, and I suspect that poor Ronald Reagan is doing somersaults in his grave in Simi, California, because the evil empire that he did so much to fight in the 1980s is now the firm ally of Washington. And that's extraordinary, I think, for anybody who might have been expecting the second Trump administration. You know, it might be incompetent and ineffective, but I think they learned a huge amount from those first 4 years. And now we're in a position, I think, where the scales have fallen from the eyes of European leaders, and they're in a completely different position now.
Okay, but so far it looked like it was appeasement all the way by European leaders. And if you look at the welcome that Trump got at Windsor Castle with all the horses and all the palaver, I mean, and he enjoyed it, he reveled in it. I mean, that was a waste of time, basically. They were trying to flatter him. And, you know, he doesn't pay any attention. And when it comes, say, to the World Cup, if there are teams coming and fans coming from countries he doesn't like, he won't care about the so-called FIFA Peace Prize. Eaten bread is always instantly forgotten by Trump.
Of course. And those European leaders who invested a huge amount in so-called Trump whispering, the notion that they could go to Washington, have a word in his ear and talk him round, I think they've all been proven completely wrong. But you mentioned what happened in London in September. I think the critical moment for Europe was actually the meeting at Trump's golf course in Scotland, because what happened there was that the Europeans caved into his extortion. They agreed to a completely disproportionate tariff regime so that American goods to Europe would come in tariff-free, but on the other side, European goods to the United States would be subject to a 15% tariff.
Why do you think they gave into that? Was it simply, stupid self-interest thinking, we have to protect as much of our exports to the United States as possible, we can't find new markets very quickly, therefore we abase ourselves to this man?
Yeah, I think it was a perfectly rational attempt to limit the damage. And I think a lot of European leaders thought that is that. We've now at least got some stability so we can look forward. But Trump is a classic playground bully. The psychology isn't difficult to understand. What he took from that meeting was these people are weak. They are our vassals. They have supplicated themselves to us. And of course, that was the signal for Trump to come back again and again, because the playground bully will always come back for another punishment beating. So if you look, for example, at the pressure the Europeans have been subjected to water down tech regulation, that, I think, would never have happened if they had actually confronted Trump in Scotland and if they had said, we are the equal of the United States in respect of trade and economy, so there's no reason to do this. But they did, and that means they've now been under pressure in all kinds of other ways. Now, I think this isn't necessarily a bad thing, because they have to confront the cold reality that the United States not only is no longer an ally, it is an adversary.
But, of course, the opportunity for Putin is to do something like invading a Baltic state, knowing that his pal Trump is not going to do anything about it. And therefore, Europe doesn't really have the kind of time required to build up, replacement assets to replace those that are currently supplied by the United States.
Well, on one level, that's true, but we shouldn't forget that already the European states collectively spend about 400 billion euros on defense and security. The Americans spend about 1 trillion per year. So it's not as if the Europeans have completely neglected security and defense. And of course, there are many, many member states of NATO in Europe that are increasing spending dramatically. Poland, for example, Germany. So that 400 billion euros is very significant. It's going to go up again year after year in the next 4 years. But the bigger challenge for Europe, absent the United States, I think, Pat, is about how you resource things centrally and how you move from the situation we have now, where there is lots of duplication, sure, the production of military hardware and so on. How do you move to a more centralized model? I think it's either via a coalition of the willing on the one hand, and secondly, with the European Union through the European Commission coordinating lots of different forms of procurement of weapons system and so forth. So a lot of that is happening, but I think the political level now, I think, realizes that whether it's a European component of NATO or whether it's a wholly European security forces, Europe is on its own. And for the first time since 1949, it has to think about defending the continent from predators like Putin without American help.
Now, the Americans spend $1 trillion, Europe spends 400 billion. So there is a disparity there. But then America has other concerns. They've got concerns in Asia Pacific. They've got to keep an eye on China. They've got to keep, military assets in those countries, in places like South Korea, in Japan. They have assets all over the place. They are deeply involved in the Middle East. They're not going to put boots on the ground, but they're putting everything else on the ground. And of course, then there's the Caribbean adventure that looks like it's going to put boots on the ground in that country, in Venezuela.
That's right. And actually, one of the virtues of the new security strategy is that it's relatively short, about 30-something pages, and it's written in very clear, kind of legible language. So I think you're absolutely right. The United States has a kind of global geopolitical map that it's engaged with, whatever the priorities of a particular administration are. For Europe, it's very different. And the priority is defending the continent against an arch predator. And I think we have to be very clear about who Putin is and what he is. And I think this is one of the great mistakes made in Europe over the last 20 years, that they didn't understand who they were dealing with. Putin is an arch opportunist. So when people say there's no way, given that level of European defense spending and rearmament, that he would even attempt to invade one of the Baltic states. Well, the same people were saying exactly the same thing about Ukraine in January 2022. Putin, like Hitler, is an opportunist in every sense. And when he senses weakness in his opponents, that's when he strikes.
Yeah.
So I think that's part of the rationale for the kind of whole-scale change that is going on in Europe currently.
Yeah, but I suppose Trump looks over at Putin in Russia and Xi in China, and he sees these guys are in charge for life, basically, unless they blot their copybooks and cause humiliation to their countries, in which case they will be removed. And Trump, of course, has only 3 years left in which to leave his mark. He may hope that there's some sort of succession, be it Vance or Rubio, or even, heaven protect us, from one of his own children. So, you know, time is running out for Trump.
Well, in every kind of rational frame of thinking, you would say that is the case. But this is a guy who tried to mount a coup d'etat in January of 2021. I don't think we should assume for a moment that Trump is actually going to leave office in 2028. He keeps dropping hints about some kind of new mechanism that they could deliver him a third presidency. So, you know, given the extraordinary things that he has done domestically in the United States, some of them almost unimaginable, even after the first term, I don't think we should assume anything about what might happen in the next presidential election. And I think it's worth saying, Pat, that if we do the comparison with Germany in 1933, the kind of moves that Trump has made in the United States are much more bold and radical than the Nazis did in their first year. For example, they didn't enact the Nuremberg laws until at least 1935 or 36. There was no significant foreign policy move until Hitler moved his troops into the Rhineland in 1935. And if you compare this to all of the assaults that Trump has made on U.S. institutions and agencies, think about what ICE has been doing on the streets of American cities. It is just as bold and radical. So we shouldn't assume that 2 years from now, the United States will have an electoral process that compares to any in
the
past.
We've all seen the movies where the Gestapo move in and they lift Jewish people off the streets. I mean, the comparison is there. It's vivid and it's seen on our televisions. And Americans maybe have gone beyond shock. That's the problem, that a lot of this stuff is being normalized, and maybe that's the way it was in Nazi Germany. You know, I'm not one of them, therefore I won't be lifted, but I am one of them, maybe I will be lifted. So you live in fear. Finally, I should ask you about his racism, his bigotry, because it's raw now, and the idea of, you know, a man with a Scottish and German heritage despising people of brown or black skin and wanting immigration from the Nordic countries, ideally. And one of the things I read yesterday, you know, the national parks, they have so many days of the year where admission to everybody is free. One of those days was Martin Luther King Day. That's gone now. You can't get in free on Martin Luther King Day. But there's another day you can get in free, Trump's birthday. I mean, that's where we're at. Imagine.
It is, and I think that speaks to the kind of cult of Trump that he has so encouraged in recent years. But on the racism, go back to the comments about Somalis within recent weeks, referring to them as garbage and suggesting that even those Somalis who were citizens of the United States, that they could be thrown out of the country. I mean, that's extraordinary. But why are people surprised? This is a guy who, during his first campaign in 2016, was mocking disabled people openly. So why are we surprised that now the normalization of racism has become almost banal? The great Hannah Arendt referred to the banality of evil when and analyzing the Nazis. I think we can make that kind of comparison very easily. And it does suggest that the trajectory that the United States has still got some way to go in 2026. And it could get a lot worse than it's been, even over these dramatic 9 or 10 months.
But the straws in the wind are, of course, that the Democrats are winning in places in small elections where they were not predicted to win. So there is maybe a natural sense of how reprehensible this individual is. One final point I want to ask you about before I let you go, John, and that is about what Putin has signaled now in the wake of the taking of the oil tanker, the Venezuelan oil tanker, by America, the seizing of, it looks like an illegal act, but anyway, that is still, I think, a debatable point. Putin has now pledged support for Maduro. So where is that going to leave the love affair between the Donald and Vladimir?
Well, I think their relationship is one that is strange, to say the least. We know that there's virtually nothing that Trump has done during this first year in office that has really challenged Putin's prerogatives or his interests. From time to time, you get this kind of sketchiness. But in terms of just material action by the United States, there's been virtually nothing. Now, Putin has this whole series of client states around the world, some of them holdovers from the Cold War. The assertiveness with which the Americans have been engaging with Venezuela may have surprised some, but I think it's completely consistent with the national security strategy, which the Russians have actually praised, because it envisages three great powers, the United States, Russia and China, and that they have absolute impunity within their spheres of interest. So for the United States, it's this recreation of the Monroe Doctrine, and I think that's why you're seeing what's happening in Venezuela. But, you know, Putin, I think, is playing on a much larger canvas, and Venezuela will be sacrificed in a heartbeat if he thinks that that will help him with the much, much more important questions that the United States has been allying with him on.
John, thank you very much for joining us. Professor John O'Brennan, Jean Monnet, Professor of European Integration at Maynooth University. Declan Power, security and defence writer, has been listening to that conversation, and we want to talk about drones. I mean, this text says, Europe is weak militarily. Allowing drones, fighter jets and Russian ships to enter Europe's zones on a weekly basis without eliminating them is weak. Why would Russia stop when all they need to do is threaten nuclear war and Europe scuttles away? Well, Ireland probably doesn't even have the vessels to scuttle away with. Declan, good morning.
Good morning, Pat. How are you?
So what do you make of the latest drone information that the air traffic control people were not made aware of the presence of these alien drones in our airspace? And could that have put some aircraft at risk?
Well, first off, I'm not entirely surprised, because the whole the whole consistent theme of this drone episode, if you like, has been about showing up holes in our command and control and overall capacity to manage this. And I think part of that is similar to our other European partners and allies, in that this drone concept, from a national security perspective, is a new thing, a new concept, and we're struggling to kind of figure out how to manage it. It's not just about getting the anti-drone technology; it's about having an appropriate strategy and placing it in its right ranking, so to speak, in terms of threat. And to come to your point there about the AirNav Ireland not being briefed, I don't know for definite, but I suspect it could be down to the fact that the threat had passed at that stage to Zelensky. The defense forces, the authorities in general, were focused on the drones themselves. They were flying at a pretty low level. I would say it was considered that they weren't seen as a threat to commercial flight paths. They weren't at that level. Having said that, though, that's still misses the point that nobody could predict exactly what they were going to do. So AirNav Ireland should have been informed, is the simple answer.
I mean, these drones were at an altitude, and all the commercial flights at that point out in the IRC would have been much higher as they approached Dublin Airport.
So I don't think there was a major threat. And I think certainly, to be fair to the authorities, and indeed to the Defence Forces and the Naval Service in particular, who would be more than aware of this, that, you know, that wasn't a top priority. But coming back to the point, there should have been a protocol. Air Nav Ireland should have been informed. But these are things, you see, this is the space we're in now. We haven't been in this space before, really. Those kinds, before, when we were dealing with a security challenge, with, say, a visit of a US president or Queen Elizabeth or somebody like that, we were able to very much manage everything on island. What we're seeing now are the stresses and strains where we have to take up the slack to deal with things that are not quite off island or offshore or semi-offshore, because heretofore there wasn't really any threat emanating there. And if there was, nobody would say it out loud, but the neighbours were looking after it.
Yeah, and that's the way it was. Yeah. By the way, Declan, as I was talking to John, I was thinking of a question I should put to you about why Trump is anxious to just make NATO disappear and the US stand on its own and Europe have to cobble together its own joint defence. Is that really about technology, that such is the military technology now, they don't actually need a presence in Europe for early warnings, although they have ambitions on Greenland, we know, but that they don't need what they used to need in Europe. They don't need troops in Germany. They don't need early warning systems. Their satellites do the job.
Yeah, that's partially perhaps some of the reason, but not the full reason. And I was spellbound there listening to John O's analysis, and it was fascinating and cogent and on point as usual. I learned something myself, and I think it's much more about, to take it from John's perspective, it's more about the geopolitics. It's more about Trump's sense of himself and where the US should be. This cult of the strong man, you know, three power blocks within the world. I think that's largely driving his posture. And indeed, this, awareness or rather re-objectification, if you like, by the US of China and other things that they see as being primarily the key focus for them, and they want to kind of throw off this burden of Europe. They don't really see Russia as being a major threat to their interests in that regard. It's not that they're suddenly going to become allies in the sense that the US had been allies with NATO, but what it does show us in Europe, whether you're in NATO or not, it's sort of immaterial. It shows us that the US are not the backstop to security and stability, and indeed the resilience of that security and stability that Europe enjoyed since the Second World War. And so, there is the challenge for Europe. And how do we navigate this increasingly totalitarian-like stance of these power blocks? Europe is rapidly, in my opinion, becoming the last bastion of rules-based order, where a community of nations, whether big and powerful or small, come together and work in a basis of friendly cooperation that lifts all boats. And that's what the European Union has been. It hasn't been perfect, but by God, this country certainly prospered socially, economically, and in every other way. And the smaller nations that joined in more recent times, such as the Baltics, saw that as well. So now we're in this kind of strange space that Ireland never expected to be in, where, okay, we're not members of NATO, but most of our European partners are. And some of our European partners, particularly the Baltics and others, are very much at the coalface of Russia's destabilizing aggression. And whether they win in Ukraine or not, it's unlikely that they're going to embark on some sort of a kinetic war or invasion. It's not beyond the realm of possibility, depending on how weak they perceive Western Europe and NATO in particular to be. If they think that the Article 5 is a beaten docket, now you could argue that Article 5 kept the peace in Europe for the entirety of the post-war years. But if they perceive that, and they ramp up this concept of hybrid warfare, which brings us back to the original topic of the drones, I think what we're looking at is a continuation and maybe a heightened level of hybrid warfare, grey zone warfare, acts that stop short of being acts of war. And Ireland is particularly vulnerable to this. If I could just give you one example, if during the European presidency we saw another example of drones, or maybe more of them, drones swarming at a location, coupled with maybe a low-level cyber attack on services across government services, state services, coupled with a rise in disinformation on the net that led to pockets of public order issues, That would be very difficult for the state to manage, literally a kind of an assault on three fronts for a small country like ours. Not to mention if there was any sort of a threat to our energy interconnectors or the internet cables. And these are the things that it's not just about doing this to antagonize Ireland. You see, if you do this to Ireland, you're causing a problem for the UK, you're causing a problem for the European Union in general. So, you know, we have to be aware that we're a target for a variety of reasons.
Okay, Declan, thank you very much for that. Declan Power, security and defence writer.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.